When you think of classic horror creatures, what comes to mind? Vampires, werewolves, demons? Absolutely. But what about the undead? Reanimated humans with just one goal in mind: to consume human flesh. These creatures are absolutely terrifying, captivating to watch on the big screen, and they are iconic to the horror genre. But did you know tales of these beings go back for centuries? And there are even some verified cases. So for today's 3-year podcast anniversary episode, we are talking about zombies. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's 3-year anniversary zombie episode, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. Happy Perplexity 3-year anniversary. I can't believe it's been 3 years. I just did my Spotify Wrapped, was like reviewing all the stats and stuff. And it's cool timing because you see all of the growth and then you get to look back and everything. But I'm just so thankful for each and every one of you. And I just want to say, before we get started, thank you so much for tuning in every week. Thank you for listening, sharing, liking, following, leaving reviews. It really means so much to me. This is like a safe space where I just get to have fun and talk about things that perplex me every week. So the fact that like people are interested in that just means a lot to me. And especially to my Perplexed Society members as well, I want to say a special thank you to you guys. You keep the lights on, and that just means so much to me. So thank you. And yeah, I wanted to do a big topic for this special 3-year anniversary episode. I have been obsessed with zombies for a very long time. I think it started around college because of The Walking Dead. There was just something about that show when it came out that just fascinated me. And I would like have watch parties at my college dorm, have people come over and watch The Walking Dead, and then we would talk about it. I dressed up as like a zombie slayer that year for Halloween. And my favorite video game of all time is The Last of Us, which is a zombie apocalypse survival game. So I've just always thought zombies were really fascinating. Anything to do with like apocalyptic times is just very like, I don't know, there's just something about it that scratches my brain. But I had no idea about the history and like the folklore around zombies. So this was really, really interesting to learn about, and I hope you guys enjoy that as well. I would like to welcome my newest Perplexed Society member. Welcome, Trista. Trista is going to get early and ad-free episodes and unlock tons and tons of bonus content. If that interests you guys, you can go to patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. I just released an episode all about prison groupies that was requested by one of my Perplexed Society members, Chelsea, and there's always new stuff going on over there. Trigger warning for today's episode. This episode will contain disturbing content that may not be suitable to some listeners, so listener discretion and all the sources will be down in the show notes. So let's get into this episode all about zombies. We're going to start first in this episode with some history and folklore. The earliest references to zombies in the United States were closely associated with slavery. This was all connected to African traditions. The word zombie was spelled for years without an E, it was just Z-O-M-B-I, and it first appeared in an American newspaper in 1838. In the story, a young African slave claimed that a zombie appeared in his master's art studio at night, but no one believed him. And it seems after this, different versions of the story were published many times in local papers throughout the 1800s. By the mid-1800s, the term zombie had become synonymous with slavery. The word became more mainstream in 1929 when a travel writer named William Seabrook released his book on Haiti and Voodoo. The book was called Magic Island. And several film scholars believe the book was the basis of the classic 1932 horror film White Zombie. And this was about white rather than African zombies. In 1968, zombies were revived again with Night of the Living Dead, directed by George Romero. And he continued releasing films like Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. Then the 80s is when it seems like zombies were really in their heyday. Even Scooby-Doo was battling zombies in their 1998 film, Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island. Then there were the zombie films that I grew up with. We had iZombie, World War Z, 28 Days, Weeks, Years, all of the things later, Shaun of the Dead, and Zombieland, just to name a few. A Stanford literary scholar named Angela Becerra Vittergar argues that zombies have remained popular because they changed mankind's perception of violence during World War II. With the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people witnessed death on a mass scale. So Vittergar theorizes that this made people fictionalize death and focus on survival of the fittest, which is a common theme in zombie narratives. Even the CDC, this is crazy, guys, they made a zombie preparedness website in 2012. You guys might remember this. It helped people prepare for the zombie apocalypse, so even they were leaning into how popular zombies are. And this site was so popular for the CDC that it crashed when it launched. Just another reason to question what the CDC says. Zombies have also arguably been referenced in the Bible, with references to the resurrection of the dead in many books, including Ezekiel and Isaiah. So let's talk about some zombie folklore from around the world, beginning in Greece. Many believe the ancient Greeks were the first civilization that may have encountered zombies, or at least that's what the Greeks thought they were. We've heard similar stories like this in other episodes I've done. There was that story, I can't remember where, but they like found a mass grave and some of the bodies had like rocks in their mouths to help them not bite people, I guess, and so they thought they might have thought these people were vampires. But there are archaeologists in Greece that have come across ancient graves with skeletons that were weighed down by large rocks and other heavy objects. So it's been theorized that this was to keep the dead in the ground. Ancient Greeks believed that after death, there was this state where a human wasn't dead or alive. They were somewhere in between. In Greece, they have vrykolakas. Sorry if I'm saying that wrong. Vrykolakas are known to eat flesh, particularly livers. It was believed that a person could become a vrykolakas after death if they were excommunicated or didn't live a holy life, and also if they were buried in ground that was unconsecrated. You could even become a vrykolakas if you ate the meat of a sheep that had been wounded by a wolf or a werewolf. So some pretty specific regulations. Henry Fanshawe Tozer wrote in 1869, quote, "The principal causes which change persons into vrykolakas after death are excommunication, heinous sins, the curse of parents, and tampering with magic arts. The first of these is the most common and most important, and dates from very early times," end quote. The first Western accounts of beliefs in vrykolakas are from the mid-17th century, by authors like Vatican Leo Alesius in 1645, Father Francois Richard in 1657, and Joseph Piton de Tournefort, who claimed he witnessed the slaying of vrykolakas on the island of Mykonos in 1701. Vrykolakas transformed into large humanoid beings that were unable to decay. They were described as having a drum-like form and being, quote, "fresh and gorged with new blood." They were reported to leave their graves and engage in ghostly activities. They would knock on villagers' homes and call them by name. And if the villager ignored their name being called, they would be left unharmed. But if they made the mistake of answering the door, it is said that these villagers would die within just a few days, and they would also turn into a vrykolakas. This led to the common superstition in Greece that you should wait for a second knock before you answer your door. Vrikolakas were even blamed for epidemics in the community. We've heard this in other folklore stories. Other legends told of the Vrikolakas entering your private chambers while you were sleeping, and they would crawl on top of the person's chest, similar to what we hear in a lot of sleep paralysis stories, like the night hag or an incubus sitting on your chest. These creatures also seem to have a lot of overlap to the vampire in Bulgarian folklore. When I was doing a lot of research about zombies, I kept finding a lot of stories and folklore that really, really link with the vampire. But the difference is they're specifically cannibals, not bloodsuckers. Vrikolakas' bodies need to be destroyed because they only become more powerful if left alone. To do this, some accounts say that you have to find the creature's body specifically on a Saturday, and this is when they rest in their graves. The most common ways to destroy the body are through exorcism, beheading, dismembering, burning or impaling the creature. Another common practice was the use of apotropics. These are objects or practices intended to prevent a recently deceased loved one from reanimating. For Vrikolakas, a wax cross and a piece of pottery with the inscription "Jesus Christ Conquers" was commonly placed on the corpse. Even as recently as the 1940s, during World War II, the belief in these creatures was still very common, particularly in rural areas of Greece. During the Great Famine from 1941 to 1942, a lot of Greeks unfortunately starved to death, and their families were very worried about how to bury their loved ones because hundreds of thousands of people were dying. So the cemeteries were overcrowded, but if they buried their loved ones outside of the cemeteries in this ground that was considered unconsecrated, they believed that their loved ones could turn into Vrikolakas. So, this is very disturbing, but some families saw no other choice but to prevent their loved ones from becoming Vrikolakas, and they did this by beheading their loved ones before burying them. I can't even imagine. So, on that lovely note, we leave Greece and we go to Japan. There's a lot of folklore about zombies in Japan as well. Specifically, I came across the legend of the Noribotoki, and this is a zombie-like spirit known to creep out of a family altar if accidentally left open at night. Noribotoki are known to have oily black skin, and they smell like death. A long tail trails behind them, and their eyes dangle from their sockets. They're able to fly, and they're known to terrorize the family that they had the altar crawl out of. They're also known to trick and give false prophecies. It's said that you can protect yourself from a Noribotoki by sprinkling salt on the floor. They also must return to the altar before sunrise, and they can't be out during the day. Hence that overlap I was talking about earlier with vampires. In Buddhism, there's also the legend of the Jikaninki. These are ghouls that feast on humans. They appear as ordinary humans, but with very sharp teeth. And they've been reported to be seen in abandoned temples and old ruins. They're described as being very unhappy, and they don't get joy from feeding. They're just miserable. They're also eternally hungry, and so feeding will temporarily relieve their pain. There are even legends about the Jikaninki that claim they are invisible during the day, and you can only see them at nighttime, which is also when they hunt. They're known to attack people who are praying alone in a temple. Similar to legends from other countries, Jikaninki were once humans who committed evil acts or could not properly pass on after death. A popular legend about the Jikaninki is the story of Musō Kakushi, a monk who was on a pilgrimage centuries ago when he got lost deep in the mountains. It started getting dark and he didn't really know where to go. So he's just looking for anywhere that he can rest, and he came across a rundown building. An elderly monk was inside and gave him directions to a nearby village. So the monk thanked him and went on to this mysterious village. And there he would meet the son of the village chief. He welcomed Musso and invited him to stay in his home as a guest. The son of the chief did warn Musso that he had recently lost his father earlier that day, and in their village they had this custom where if someone in the village died, all of the villagers had to spend the night outside of the village, otherwise they would be cursed. So they were all leaving for the night, but if Musso wanted to stay there by himself, he could, but he needed to be aware of the risks. And Musso was so tired from his journey that despite this warning, he decided to stay overnight, specifically in the chief's son's house. He figured it was fine because he wasn't a member of the village. So that night, everyone except for Musso left, and he stayed in the village all alone. He recited prayers that night for the village chief, when suddenly he felt a presence nearby. Musso suddenly became paralyzed. He could not move, and he noticed out of the corner of his eye, there was a dark, shadowy figure creeping towards the village chief's body. The creature devoured the remains of the chief, while Musso could only watch in horror. Then the creature slipped away. So the next day, all of the villagers returned, and Musso told them of the horrors that he had seen, and obviously they're going to come across the chief's half-eaten body, so he has some explaining to do. He then left the village, and once again, he came across the monk that was in the abandoned building, who told him to go to this village. He gave him directions. So Musso starts talking to this monk again, and this is when the monk confessed that it was him who had devoured the chief's corpse last night. He explained to Musso that long ago, he was a priest and lived in that same village. He performed funeral services for the dead, but he had a lack of conviction. And because of this, when he died, he was cursed and reborn as a Jikininki. Now he was forced to feed off of the dead. He begged Musso to kill him and save him from his torment. Then the elderly monk and the abandoned building disappeared. Musso is obviously super disoriented and confused. He's looking around and all he sees is like dirt and grass, and he's just completely alone. The only thing that was nearby him was an ancient moss-covered gravestone. So maybe this was the grave of the monk that had turned into a Jikininki. Then we go to Haiti, and this is where you'll find most stories about the zombie. Zombies are very closely connected to Haitian beliefs and the voodoo culture. It's possible that zombie folklore originated in Haiti in the 17th century. In fact, the word zombie actually comes from a Haitian Creole word, zonbi, which is believed to derive from the Kikongo word zumbi. I don't know how to say this exactly. It's N-Z-U-M-B-I, so it might be Nzumbi. But this means soul or spirit of the dead. And in Haitian culture, there is a very palpable fear of your soul being stolen. And if this happens to them, it's believed that this is the worst thing that could happen. It's worse than death itself. In some parts of Haiti, it's believed witches will bring humans back to life, and they will turn them into what is known as a Isith Fontella. They cut out their tongues and they drive a peg into their brain. In Haitian voodoo, there are also stories of the Gid, which is a guardian of the dead, a deity usually portrayed in a black top hat and a black tail coat who waits for souls at the eternal crossroads. West African slaves worked in Haiti on sugarcane plantations under very horrific conditions. These slaves were forced to work for long hours in Haiti's very humid and hot climate. They were physically abused, with the French plantation owners using extreme violence to control them. These slaves had to live in extremely harsh, unsanitary, and cramped conditions. They weren't given proper clothing or food. Families were separated, and their children were sold off on the slave market. Slaves had absolutely no rights, no education. They weren't allowed to openly practice their indigenous religious beliefs, traditions from their homelands. And so there is this belief that these stories of zombies actually stemmed from slavery, because it was like you were a zombie. You couldn't express yourself at all. You had no freedom whatsoever. The death rate during all of this was also so high that half of these Black people died within just a few years. Today, in some parts of the world, voodoo is still a popular practice. Many people who follow the voodoo religion now say that zombies are myths, but not everyone. There are voodoo practitioners known as Bokor, and their job is to revive the dead. Unlike the Hollywood version of zombies, Haitian zombies are not usually depicted as flesh-eating monsters, actually. The zombie and Bokor relationship mirrors the master-slave dynamic, where death was often seen as a merciful escape from the brutal realities of slave labor. Zombification is considered by some as a form of resistance against slavery as well. So some people say that it was a strategy used by secret societies formed by runaway slaves. So basically, these slaves who would escape would develop poisons and remedies, and they would poison newborns to spare them from the horrors of slavery. And they would also allegedly use them on other slaves who had not escaped so that their masters would want to get rid of them. They would turn them into this zombie-like version of themselves where it didn't seem like they were cognitively, physically with it to be able to do the work. But these potions, they were like a temporary effect. So once they were gotten rid of by their masters, then they could have freedom and return to their normal selves. With the master-slave dynamic with the Bokor, they would create powders containing special herbs, animal parts, and a key ingredient known as tetrodotoxin. This is a neurotoxin found in some marine life, including the pufferfish. It's very deadly, and it's been known to cause difficulty walking, breathing, and confusion. In higher doses, it can even cause paralysis and coma. So theoretically, if someone was given a dose of tetrodotoxin from a Bokor, they could demonstrate symptoms of being a zombie, and they could be easily controlled. Salt is known as one of the antidotes for tetrodotoxin. It's believed that a zombie who tastes salt will regain their senses. As the Haitian proverb goes, quote, "Zombie goût celui pas mande ret," which translates to "a zombie who tastes salt will not ask to stay." In Haiti, there are a lot of stories of zombies, and these stories are very important. They're steeped in the realities of past oppressions and current fears. They continue to shape the Haitian understanding of life, death, and beyond. According to anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston, a zombie symbolizes more than just a spectral figure. It's about the fears of people that have been controlled, how they've been forced to follow these unfair contracts, and they're going through this supernatural retribution. So now let's discuss some possible cases of zombification in both humans and insects and plants. Ophiocordyceps is a genus of fungi with more than 200 known species, and this is known to target and infect various insects, and they do this through their spores. Ophiocordyceps are known to feed on the insects they attach to, kind of like a parasite, and they grow into and out of their bodies. If you have watched The Last of Us, you should be familiar with this. So these ophiocordyceps, they take total control of the ant's muscle fibers, and they literally control their every move like a puppet master until the insect dies. When the ophiocordyceps infect carpenter ants specifically, they become compelled to climb really, really high up, and they'll stay up there until they die. The reason that the ophiocordyceps want these ants to do this is because the higher up they go, the better this fungus will grow. Recently, a zoologist named Philippe Fernandez-Fournier was working with a team in the Ecuadorian Amazon. And during this exploration, they discovered a previously known species of the Zadipoda wasp. These wasps can actually control spiders from the Anolosimus eximus species. These spiders are normally very social, and they actually will like hunt and live in groups. But Fernandez-Fournier was noticing that some of these spiders were starting to go off on their own, and they were acting really strange. They started weaving these cocoon-like webs in very remote locations. These spiders had become infected with this wasp, Zadipoda larva. So when the researchers were looking at these weird cocoon-like webs and opened them up, they found this wasp larva growing inside. So they keep looking at this, and it became clear that these wasps were laying eggs on the abdomen of these A. eximius spiders. They hatched larvae that were then feeding on the spider and slowly taking control of its body. And the larva would get more and more control until they were able to get the spiders to go off on their own and build these cocoon-like nests, which would then allow the larva to grow into adult wasps. When this was done, the wasp larva would then devour the spider. More recently, in 2014, researchers in France found a 30,000-year-old virus, and they named this Pithovirus cibericum. This really freaks me out. So this is a giant DNA virus, meaning that while it's still tiny, it's easily seen under the microscope. Pithovirus cibericum contains hundreds of genes, and this is insane when compared to other DNA viruses that only have, like, say, a dozen genes. What this means is having this much DNA makes the virus that much harder to kill because it can change easier to fit its environment and protect itself. So these scientists, for whatever godforsaken reason, reanimated this disease, and they infected amoebas and ancient unicellular organisms. Luckily, this very ancient giant virus isn't harmful to humans or other animals, but the reason this is so scary to me is scientists warn that there are similar giant viruses that could remain buried inside the permafrost, and theoretically, these could be very dangerous to humans. And with climate change being on the rise, these viruses could theoretically be defrosted, and it could be the end of civilization. So there's your happy fun fact for the day. The same year that this giant virus was discovered, researchers in the UK were also studying what they called zombie plants. A bacteria known as phytoplasma was infecting these plants, such as goldenrods, and it was causing their yellow flowers to be replaced with these weird leaves, and these leaves were actually attracting more insects, making it easier for the bacteria to continue to spread and infect other plants. Researchers were perplexed by how the phytoplasma could control the plant and make it grow different blooms. So it's pretty crazy to think about how these living organisms can attach to another living organism and control it. And while it is rare, there are, believe it or not, several credible reports in medical journals of cases of human zombification. So let's get into it, and let's see if your mind is blown, because mine certainly was. In 1997, the British medical journal, The Lancet, described a few verifiable cases of zombies. In the first case, a 30-year-old Haitian woman who had died and was buried in her family tomb reappeared alive 3 years later. She was identified through distinctive facial marks, and her tomb, when they examined it, had been filled with stones. I'm wondering if this was from that belief we talked about in Greece. Maybe it's in other countries as well where they try to weigh the body down. I don't know. Let me know what you guys think. So when they find their daughter, this woman's parents admitted her to a local psychiatric hospital. And the woman was studied by medical professionals. The study authors would say about the woman, quote, "She kept her head in a lowered position and walked extremely slowly and stiffly, barely moving her arms. She was also unable to communicate, but would occasionally murmur some incomprehensible but stereotyped words," end quote. I'm also obviously wondering where this woman was for the last 3 years. The researchers also completed an electroencephalogram, and they looked at her central nervous system, but all of these exams were unremarkable. They couldn't find any explanation for why she was in this zombie-like state. The best diagnosis they could come up with was catatonic schizophrenia. So it's a type of schizophrenia where they're unable to talk, pretty much. But they really could not find any explanation for how she seemingly came back from the dead and where she had been for the last 3 years. Then there is a very famous case, and this is the story of the Haitian man, Clervius Narcisse. He entered a local hospital on April 30th, 1962. He was not doing well. He was having a lot of difficulty breathing, and hospital records confirmed that he walked into this hospital's emergency room at 9:45 p.m. He was feverish, he had body aches, he was spitting up blood, and he said for the past few days he had been feeling very sick and it just wasn't getting better. So the doctors look at his medical history, trying to figure out what could possibly be causing this. And his medical history was significant for digestive disorders, pulmonary edema, hypothermia, respiratory issues, and hypotension or low blood pressure. And his doctors couldn't diagnose this new mystery illness, but he just kept getting more and more sick. His lips were turning blue, and he was feeling weird tingling, kind of like neuropathy, all over his body. Then he slipped into a coma. 3 days after Clervius entered the hospital, according to their records, he died on May 2nd. The attending physicians, an American among them, would declare him dead. They signed Clervius's death certificate, and they put his body in cold storage for 20 hours. Then he was buried. This burial had some family members present, including his sister, Angela. So everyone confirms, he died, he was buried, etc. Okay, so this is 1962. Now we flash forward, you ready? 18 years later, 1980, okay? Angela, the sister, is bopping around minding her business in their village, and a man approaches her. She's just in the market doing some shopping, and he's like, "Hey," and he introduces himself. He's like, "I'm blah, blah, blah," and he specifically uses Clervius's childhood nickname. And he starts mentioning these very intimate facts that only a family member would know about Clervius. This man is insisting that he is Clervius and Angela is his sister. Obviously, Angela is incredibly spooked and confused by all of this, and she needs answers. There were doctors, townspeople, and other family members that are all quickly hearing this story. The rumor mill, I'm sure, was just going insane. And other family members were also able to identify this man as Clervius. He spoke slowly. He kind of had this labored speech, but otherwise, he seemed normal. So obviously, they're wondering what the hell happened that night that he quote-unquote died. And quote-unquote Clervius would say he remembered that night well. He said he remembered being lowered into his grave But during that time, he said he felt paralyzed. He couldn't speak, he couldn't move. He also has, in 1980, this scar on his right cheek, and he claimed this came from a nail being driven through his casket and cutting his face. He said while he was in the casket, he felt like his skin was on fire, and it felt like insects were crawling underneath his skin. The same night of his burial, a Bokor, the witch, and one of his assistants raised Clairvius from the grave. Clairvius was then beaten, gagged, and taken to a sugar plantation in northern Haiti, where he was forced to work as a slave amongst other zombies. He felt during this time that he was in a dreamlike state. He couldn't control his movements, and he said everything felt like it was happening in slow motion, kind of like a dream. Clairvius continued to work on this plantation for 2 years until the Bokor died. Allegedly, the Bokor was actually murdered by one of the other zombie victims. And then Clairvius spent the next 16 years wandering through the Haitian countryside. I don't know how he made do, but pretty insane. He did write to his family often, apparently, but never heard back from them. And Clairvius said the reason he didn't come back to his village sooner is because, dun dun dun, he feared bumping into his brother. So turns out Clairvius had a huge falling out with his brother before he died and got sick. And about the time that Clairvius reappeared, there were also two women that turned up in another village saying the same thing had happened to them. In northern Haiti, the local peasants claimed to have found a group of zombies also wandering around aimlessly in the fields. So it seems like there was some shady shit going on. One theory in this case, because we still really don't know what could have happened to Clairvius. One theory is that Clairvius Narcisse was intentionally poisoned by someone. His symptoms very much line up with the side effects of tetrodotoxin, that poisoning from the pufferfish we were talking about earlier. When he went to the hospital, he was having difficulty breathing, his lips were blue, he had fatigue, body aches, low blood pressure, and he also later experienced some paralysis. Turns out, Clairvius had abandoned his children, and he also had this big land dispute with his brother, the one that he had the falling out with. Allegedly, Clairvius stole land from the brother. Clairvius also claimed the brother then sold him off to a Bokor for revenge, and that he had been, quote, tried and found guilty by the masters of the land. So a big person in like zombie research with Haiti is a guy named Wade Davis. He's an ethnobotanist from Harvard, and he went to Haiti in 1982, 2 years after Clairvius has mysteriously returned back to this village. I guess he had heard about his story and wanted information. I can't blame him. Davis basically said he hoped that he could gain a better understanding of zombification. He was just so perplexed as like how this works. So he was able to interview Clairvius along with another woman named T. Femme, who also claimed to have been a victim of zombification. Davis would conclude that within voodoo, allegedly, there are secret societies that sometimes use or threaten zombification to maintain order within the village. It seemed that what happened to Clairvius was not random, but rather a form of capital punishment. He had left his children, he had screwed over his brother, the village basically hated him. Davis also believed that Clairvius and T. Femme had in fact been poisoned with tetrodotoxin. In order to be poisoned by tetrodotoxin, you have to put it in someone's open wound or in their food. And like I said when we were talking about Haitian folklore, for rural Haitians, zombification is worse than death. It takes away their free will and independence. Bokors have also been reported to give their zombie victims a paste to continue to control them. It's believed that this paste is made out of sweet potatoes, cane syrup, and datura. This is the key ingredient. Datura is a plant known as Cucumbre zombie, or the zombie cucumber. Datura contains hallucinogens that cause delirium, confusion, psychosis, and even amnesia. When talking to Davis, Clairvius described this paste that he remembered regularly being given by the Bacor, so it seems like this is what had happened. He had the Datura, the zombie cucumber, and the tetrodotoxin at least once. Typical symptoms of DS, or Datura poisoning, include neurological disorders like ataxia, which is when you can't really control your walking and your movements. It can impair short-term memory. It can make you very confused, disoriented. You can even have visual and auditory hallucinations. You can have psychosis. You can be delirious, and you can even experience seizures and coma. With DS poisoning, the symptoms will usually happen within an hour after you ingest it, and the clinical symptoms may persist up to 24 to 48 hours. So if Clairvius was under the control of a Bacor for 2 years, he would have had to have had a lot of this zombie cucumber. The victims of zombification are also said to be fed a salt-free diet to further control them, which would cause very, very low energy. So that's the mysterious case of Clairvius Narcisse, who it seems was a victim of zombification. And that, everybody, is our episode all about zombies. Season 3 is coming to an end, so I want to know from you guys what you want in Season 4. What was also your favorite episode? And yeah, I'm so thankful for each and every one of you. And if you haven't done so yet, please, please, please subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Just interact any way you can. Hit any and all of the buttons. You guys have no idea. That helps so, so much. I know it's annoying with algorithms and stuff, but this is a very saturated market. So the more you do that, the better. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Tell people about the show. And if you want to support the show further, if you want early and ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, you can join the Perplexed Society. Check out patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. It's a community. There's over 80 episodes over there to unlock. And right now is a great time to join because I am running a special on Patreon right now where you will get your first month on any tier 50% off. So that's zombies, everybody. I hope that didn't scare you too much or spiral you into a depression. But I do think that the folklore, the history is so interesting. I can't believe that there are some maybe real legit cases of it. And it was interesting to learn more about the cordyceps because I'm such a big fan of The Last of Us. So hearing cases with insects and plants, I just think it's really, really interesting. Though it is very macabre. But yeah, that wraps up today's episode, everyone. You all are amazing. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. And I will talk to you next week. Bye. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Assistant producer is TJ McRae. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. Music for this episode is from Pixabay. If you enjoyed today's episode, leave a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a story to share or a topic request, email perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And you can always unlock early and ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content by joining the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Until next week, stay curious.